I was really overwhelmed whenever I was asked to participate in this. I'm really grateful. Long way from those gutters, I tell you. And hell, I thought my group had forgot about me. Here they go. Nobody said nothing or nothing. But my wife's birthday is 2 days after mine, or sobriety day. And tonight I was saying, "When's your birthday?" You know. So they did remember. Thank goodness. That's the way it is. Love me whenever I don't even deserve it. Anyway, I'm up here to introduce Joe tonight. And I was fortunate enough, Norman let me have a copy of his tape, a recent tape, and I was able to listen to it. And I could not believe the similarities between him and I and our alcoholism and the things that we did. They say if you stay around here long enough, you'll hear your own story. And I felt like I had, and when I met him, picked him up from the airport, him and his wife Vanessa, I automatically clicked with him. I felt like I'd known him all my life. Really, I have. But I'm really proud to introduce Joe. He's from Cincinnati. He's a member of the Giant East 4th Street Group in Cincinnati, Ohio. And he really enjoys his sobriety, and he has a true humility about his sobriety. And we've been able to share 24 hours together, and I'm glad to introduce him tonight to you as your speaker. Thank you.
I've never been called humble in my life.
Can we turn the clock back an hour now? That's the first thing that came to my mind when he said I was humble. My name is Joe. I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. I want to thank everybody that made it possible for me to be here this weekend with my wife. My wife doesn't get to go with me too many places. And when she does, I think I give a better talk when I'm with her, to be honest with you. I don't know why, I just do. Frank gave us a tour of St. Simon's and around the island. As we were going over the bridge onto St. Simon, he said, "And over there is where they make lithium." They have a lithium factory over there. I told him, I said, "Those people work shift work, but it doesn't seem to bother them." Oh, goodness. Goodness. I tell you what, it's good to see people that I've known over the years. I met Michael, and I was fortunate enough to meet her husband this weekend. And you're a lucky man. She's a hell of a nice gal. There's something really attractive about a person that's honest, and she's honest. I like that. And Father Pete, I heard him in Indianapolis not too long ago, and you're in for a treat tomorrow. I thoroughly enjoyed his story. He had me laughing so hard my stomach was hurting. And I enjoyed Babs today. You know, Babs kind of got me, just kind of tweaked me a little bit there. I'm glad she didn't talk anymore. I'd have been crying. But she gave one hell of an Al-Anon talk, and there'll be no Al-Anon jokes tonight, no. I know this, if it wasn't for Al-Anon, I wouldn't be a married man today. You got to do something to put up with somebody like me, and she had to do something in order to save her own sanity. And I'm glad she did. I'm really grateful to Al-Anon. I just thoroughly enjoyed the people who stood up and had a year and 9 months and 6 months and all that. I'm talking up here Saturday night, and I want to let you people know, I don't know why I've been fortunate enough to be able to put words on what I think and what I feel. Some people can do that and some can't. Obviously I can or I wouldn't be here. But that doesn't give me a spiritual edge up on anybody in this room. I'm your average alcoholic. I can't drink any better than you can. I'm at the same meeting you are tonight. I just happen to be talking. Maybe next year it'll be your turn. It's my turn tonight. You know, I'm your average guy. Really, I'm your average guy. I'm not well educated. I finished a 10th grade of high school. I backed into a GED when I ran away into the Navy. So I'm not educated by society standards. I don't make a lot of money. We live in a house. It's a little 3-bedroom house, bath and a half, detached car garage, and all the houses in the neighborhood look like they were cut out of cookie cutters. I'm not well known, and I'm not famous. And for those of you who stood up with a year or less of sobriety, I want you to know that it's possible to stay sober over 19 years and be happy most of the time and not amount to a goddamn thing. So you, the guy with the 3 days, the heat's off. Just kick back. Just keep coming back, kick back, listen a little while, see if we're lying or not, keep coming back. So, I've been sober since October the 5th, 1978, and I'm still in awe of that myself because I didn't pick the day I was going to get sober. You know, I didn't say, well, I'm going to pick that day. Matter of fact, I had a hard time with Alcoholics Anonymous the first year and a half I came around AA. I was not a quick study. I needed to be beaten into a state of reasonableness before I started to listen to what other people had to say. And I'm very hard-headed. I'm still that way today. My mother's an alcoholic. She's been sober over 26 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. She's the person who introduced me to AA. My brother's been sober over 13 years in the Ohio State Penitentiary. They got AA in there. That's the way he had to get sober, and he got sober. My father's been sober, never did find sobriety. He's 74 next month. And we all weren't loony all the time. There was a time in our lives where we all weren't sick all at the same time. We got sick one at a time. Came from a good family. Good, really a good family. We lived on a dead-end street. The day they call them cul-de-sacs. To me, they're dead ends. I didn't even know what cul-de-sac meant till 83. Cul-de-sac. And we lived in a little 2-bedroom house, and we had a good life. We really did. My mother and father were good parents, and they did not choose to have alcoholism any more than I chose to be an alcoholic. We all just were. And I know this. There's a lot of alcoholism on both sides of our family. There's no doubt about that. My childhood isn't any different than anybody else's, but there were a few strange, peculiar things that I couldn't quite put my finger on. You know, when other kids were going to Coney Island and camping out for the summer, we were going to places like Cell Block 6 and Building A to visit relatives. You know, I don't know what that was. I think it was alcoholism. You know, my mother's mother, I remember going to visit Grandma at the state mental institution. We'd all get in cars, and her sisters, my aunts and cousins, and we'd all go out there, and we'd all go visit Grandma, and depending on how much medication she was on that day, would determine whether you could understand her or not. And everybody else act like they understood her, and she'd just be rocking back and forth, and you know, spit running down, and all the time, just You ever notice that? You ever go to mental institutions? We're always moving. I need water. And that's the way she was. And they just said she had problems. And I know this. I felt weird going there. And there wasn't anybody else on our street going there to visit any of their relatives. And Grandma was an alcoholic. That's the way they treated alcoholism back then. Grandma lived in that state mental institution for 40 years. She died in that institution when she was 64 years old. She went in a young woman at 24. And that's how they treated alcoholism at the state mental institution where I live in Ohio. And I'm sure they did that for years. They didn't know what to do with us. They had no solution for people like us. And I'm sure they experimented on her and gave her a lot of stuff that we didn't know about because you couldn't understand her most of the time. She was shot. She was gone. And well, we would do things like that, and I couldn't put my finger on it. You know, I'd go to school, and they'd want us to buy a book report on what you did this summer. That's kind of hard to put words on, you know. Well, I'll tell you something. God was preparing me for my boys. They're going to be 13 and 14 because a couple years ago, they had to write a book report on what they did that summer. They had just come back from seeing their uncle at the penitentiary. So I was real useful. What goes around comes around. That's something. But, I don't know why I'm talking about that. But anyway, I started growing up and had a good time. I really had a good childhood. You know, I had supportive parents and everything. My mother's drinking, her drinking took off first. And mom, they used to prescribe speed for women for everything in the 50s and 60s. Everything from toxemia to losing weight to everything. And she had black mollies, black and whites, all whites. And she would drink these quarts of beer on the speed. And she's about 5'2" and weighed about 190 pounds. And she's always like this. You know, and it's funny now, but I was ashamed. I was ashamed of what alcoholism had made my mother turn into. I remember it. I remember walking up the street as a kid. We didn't have a car. Dad had the car. Mom and me and my brother, we rode the bus everywhere. And Mom would take her shopping cart with all her empty quarts clanging up the street to go to the local pony keg to buy a pound of bologna, a pound of cheese, a loaf of bread, and 8 quarts of beer. And I would see one of my buddies coming up the street. And I remember being 9 or 10 years old walking with my mother. And I was ashamed of how my mother looked. I was ashamed of that. And I would walk on the other side of the street and act like I didn't even know her. I could never figure out how can I love somebody so much and be ashamed of them at the same time. It was alcoholism. That's what it was. But I didn't know that till I got sober in AA. She would do strange things like break her bottles in the basement so nobody would know she had empties when she put them out in the garbage. I remember catching her one day. She had rolled up all these bottles and was beating them with a hammer, trying to crush them all up so she could get them in a small container and get them in the can. But she had crushed too many and failed to empty them out for a few weeks, and it was too heavy. She couldn't get them up the steps. I remember, Mom, what are you doing? Nothing. Well, just nothing. She got this big bag, and she can't get it. I said, what is that? She says, nothing. And as my mother's drinking progressed, my mother and father's marriage started to fall apart. This really is a family illness. It really is a family illness. And I remember I was about 12 years old. My brother was 9. And my father had us in the backyard, and he says, you know, if it wasn't for you two boys, I'd be long gone. Your mother's crazy. And, you know, it appeared that Mom was crazy because she acted like her mother in the state mental institution when she drank and got on that speed and that beer. And Dad don't lie when you're a kid. Dad's telling you the truth. Why would Dad lie to you? Dad was telling the truth as he saw it. And so we said, yeah, Mom is crazy. He's right. And thanks for hanging around, Dad. But wasn't until I got sober that I found out he just washed his hands clean if anything went wrong in that family at that time. But we didn't know that as kids. And my father did most of his drinking away from home. So we didn't get to see full effects of that until 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. And I was about 13 years old. It was the 60s. And I don't mean this to offend anybody. This is what happened to me. And it was the 60s, and people in the 60s were doing some bizarre things. They were letting their hair grow down to their rear ends. They were marching. They were rioting. They were doing drugs. They were smoking marijuana and doing all that stuff. Really, it was out of rebellion, I think. But I was 13 years old, I started smoking marijuana. And the reason I bring this up to you is just this, because of what my book says. I don't know what yours says, but mine has a chapter called More About Alcoholism, Chapter 3. And it says, people like me, through every form of self-deception and experimentation, will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore not an alcoholic. I'd have done anything to keep from being an alcoholic like I saw my mother and father. I mean, I'd have been an addict. You know what I mean? At least that's got some dignity to it. But nobody wants to be alcoholic. Jesus, that's dirty when you say it. I mean, I remember, and I can identify with what Michael was saying about in her head, she had made up her mind she was never going to be like her mother. And I thought, wow, that's how I thought. You know what I mean? And I think only alcoholics try to prove they're not alcoholic. I didn't know that till I got to AA. I went for a long time to a maximum security AA meeting at the penitentiary on Monday nights. It's called the New Freedom Group. I had never met anybody in there who was a social drinker trying to prove they were alcoholic. It was always the alcoholic trying to prove that he was not. And that was me. And it just happened to be so convenient. It was the 60s. It was wide along to some kind of revolt or something bizarre like Kent State. You could have drugs and be cool and be fashionable. Fashionable things today is earrings in the eyes, in the nose, in the tongue. And, you know, if I'd have grew up in that era, I'd have been doing it. I'd have been searching. And I started smoking that marijuana, and this guy, I was 14 years old, he says, why don't you try some of this LSD to give you a better understanding of yourself and the world you live in? And that sounds good to somebody 14. And I tried that, and about 400 trips later, I didn't understand anything better than the first one. I just didn't. But I know this. The guy who gave me that stuff, who introduced me to it, was not like me. Was not like me. We would run out of that stuff, and he'd say, why don't we wait a little while and he'll be back? I said, well, why don't we go up the street and get a couple quarts of Miller and drink them down and wait for him to get back? He said, no. He said, Joe, that stuff doesn't do anything for me. It makes me sick to my stomach, a little bit sleepy, and I want to go home and call it a night. You go ahead on. And at 14, I had the mind of an alcoholic, because you know what I thought? You're weird. You can sit here with that sad sack look on your face if you want. I'm going to get me a couple quarts of Miller. And at 14, if you pony keg, why are you getting those quarts of beer? I thought you were this hippie. I thought you were a doper, Joe. I'd have given you the excuse. Every alcoholic needs an excuse to drink. They don't know why. They've lost my car. Got fired from my job. It's raining out. Can't find any drugs. My father-in-law has five beers, never has had five beers because he ran out of drugs. But alcoholics do, and if you're new in AA and you don't know what you are, I got one question for you. Do you drink Diet Coke when you run out of drugs? Alcohol is a solution for everything for the alcoholic, even running out of drugs. It worked for not having a job. Yeah, he was a little weird. He was. He was weird. And I used to be one of those people that said, oh, a drug is a drug, a drug. It's all the same. Well, when I got sober and I looked back on it, I found out in my life it was not all the same. I don't know if you here, any of you here did that LSD, but my idea of a good time on that stuff's not a crowded shopping center at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. There's too many things moving around at one time. My idea of a good time on that, somebody's basement, 4 in the morning. You just do that stuff with one other person. Because if there's 3 or more, the conversation gets too confusing. You just forget it. You just call it a night and wait for stuff to wear off. But when I drank alcohol, it didn't matter if I was in a crowded shopping center at 5 in the afternoon or somebody's basement at 4 in the morning. When that alcohol hit and it went down, you know what happened to me? Boom! Let's go! God! God! Oh, this feels so good! Let's get as many people as we can! Let's party! And somebody said, would you shut up?
It's 4 a.m. Get in the car. It's 4 a.m. Yeah, but I feel so good. That's what alcohol did for me. So I know all that stuff's not the same. But I didn't know that till I got sober. I started getting in a lot of trouble. I had joined the Boy Scouts before all this stuff happened, and I had a good future going for me. I did. I didn't know it till I got sober and looked back at my life. I joined the Boy Scouts when I was 11 years old, and I was a little over 14. I was an Eagle Scout. General Westmoreland gave me my Eagle Scout Award, Time Magazine's Man of the Year, along with 99 other boys. My sponsor at that time was President Langsam, University of Cincinnati. About a week before the ceremony, he called me in his office, and all the boys that made Eagle Scout, they had a sponsor, President of GE, President of Procter & Gamble, President of University of Cincinnati, like their mentor, and asked them what they wanted to do with their lives and tried to help them to go in that direction. And this president of the University of Cincinnati says, Joe, you keep getting good grades like you're getting, and we'll make sure you get a college education. Call me. When you're 16, 17, get a hold of me. Here's my number. Call me. I thought he was just trying to be nice to me. Because he's there hosting these Boy Scouts. They got to be nice to you. He don't really mean it. And then after the ceremony, this General Westmoreland, I was tall then like I am now. It's like 70 pounds lighter. And he said, have you ever thought of joining the military as an officer? I'm 14 years old. I've never really given that any thought. He said, we have a place for West Point. He says, Howard says, if you keep getting good grades, we might talk about that. Here's a number I want you to call. And I just thought he was being nice to me. He had to. He was there for that event. You know, he's being nice to kids. I didn't really realize the full impact of what these men were telling me. And at that time in my life, I could tell you what I wanted to do with my life, how I was going to do it, the plan I was going to use, plan A, and if plan A doesn't work, we'll try plan B. There were no problems. There were obstacles to go around, over, under, through, but there weren't any problems. I could tell you what I was going to do. I brimmed over with self-confidence. A man from alcoholism, by the time he was 23 years old, was sitting in a local restaurant and had to have somebody tell him that he made enough money to buy a car. I said, really? I mean, you're not kidding me. The numbers add up, don't they? I mean, if I put $50 in here and $25 there, I'll have enough for rent and a car? Really? I surely couldn't believe myself anymore. Alcoholism had robbed me of my own self-confidence, my belief in humanity, my belief in anything. I was second-guessing myself and everything. It robbed me of the way God designed me to be. And I started to do these weird things in the 60s and the 70s, and that was right after being an Eagle Scout. And by the time I'm 16 years old, I'm running away from home. I'm running away from home. I'm hitchhiking because I'm having a bad day. I had an argument with my mother, sober. February, 9 cents in my pocket, hitchhike all the way to Naples, Florida from Cincinnati. February, that's not too smart. They didn't teach you to do that in the Boy Scouts. And I caught myself sober, but I'm 16 years old in a flop house in Naples, beating a tambourine on the corner thinking, Jesus, when are we going to eat? And what am I doing here? How did I get myself in this situation? Just a few years ago, I had plans for my life. I could tell you what I was going to do and how I'm going to do them, and now I got to go here to get a meal. A few weeks ago by, I go back home, get you know, homesick. One time I ran away from home, he got a kick out of this. My hair was out to here. I had one of them big afros. You remember them where you turn your head and the hair catch up to it, just slow. I've always had hair like this, and I was a geek. Jimi Hendrix came along, I was styling. I was doing all right. Jimmy saved me. And I had hair out to here, and the boy that was with me, he had hair down to his rear end. And we got pulled over in Cordele, Georgia for hitchhiking. And I remember it like it was yesterday. My rear end gets tight talking about it now. Now, Do you remember the old Dodge commercial with the heavyset guy and the mirror glasses? What you got under the hood, boy? He come up to me and that guy that was with me, and my hair's out to here. It's 1971. And he had this long, tall, spring bean deputy fellow with him. He looked at me, and he looked at the guy with me, and he looked back at me again. And he said, "What you doing down here, Yankee?" And that wasn't too bad. But he looked at me real close again. He said, "You white or black, boy?" I had just seen that movie, Deliverance. And my rear end tightened up. And the guy with him, the deputy, said, "We could tie these boys up, throw them in the swamp. Nobody know nothing about it." And I thought about that movie again where the guy said, "He sure got a pretty set of lips on him, don't he?" They scared the hell out of us, and I think that's all they wanted to do. I think they were bored, and they said, "There's two Yankees, let's get them." And they made us walk 9 miles back out to the expressway in the rain. And I said, how am I getting caught in these situations like this? That's sober. I ran away from home again a few months later, 16 turning on 17 now. And I'm a busboy in a Chinese restaurant in North Miami Beach. They don't have merit badges for that. But there I was, bussing tables at 17 years old. I thought, I don't know what's wrong with me. And the whole time, my drinking is starting to progress. And I came back and I was given, you could either go into the military or you could go to jail for a long time. And I thought, I'm going to the military. And I went into the Navy thinking I'm going to start over and straighten my life out. I knew my life was out of control. I knew that. But I didn't know why. I had no idea. And at 17 years old, I found myself in the Philippine Islands. And I thought, I'm in trouble. I can't hitchhike across the Pacific when I'm having a bad day. I thought, I have to get out of here. Because, see, the Navy interfered with my drinking terribly. And I told these older fellas, I'm going to get out. They said, "You can't." Babs, my mind said, "You watch me." And within a year and a half, I was out. I played a game to get out and told them I had flat feet. My feet look weird, but I can run like a goose. You know, I never did have any problems with it. And I came home to help my mother. Now, I'm sick now. I've been drinking pretty heavy for the past year and a half and doing all those other strange things. And I came home to help my mother. Now, my mother had been sober 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. I was 19 years old. And my mother tried to help me. My mother told me the truth, and I thought she was crazy. I would come home drunk. She said, "Joe, you have a problem with your memory because you're a sober member of AA. You don't have anybody. Go take that stuff somewhere else." I had good jobs, but I lost them because of my drinking. There was opportunity, and I had a lot of opportunities for good jobs, but I drank myself out of them. And I had become a violent drunk. My behavior was totally unpredictable. I would come home drunk at 3 and 4 in the morning and put my fist through walls in my mother's house and tear doors off the hinges, throw lamps, burn her furniture with cigarettes, passed out drunk, not knowing what's wrong with me. Literally had no idea kitchen that I was never taught to call anybody. And even drunk, I thought to myself, "What did you say that for? Why did you say that?" And you can't take those words back. And my mother's sponsor and a social worker finally got up enough nerve and common sense to kick me and my brother out. And I like to say this about my mother. My mother's one of the greatest influences in my life. Because the greatest thing she ever did for me is she kicked my butt out. Dark. she told me, she said, Joe, I'm not going to live like this no more. I hear the sirens go off. I go straight through the ceiling at 3 in the morning. The phone rings. I think you're in jail. Somebody knocks on a door. I think it's the police again. She said, you have a problem, and I know you don't know it, and you aren't going to do anything about it. You're going to have to get out. I'm not going to participate in your suicide no more. That had to be one of the hardest things for a mother to do. I'm a father, and I could see myself doing it, but boy, I don't know about a mother. That's got to be a tough thing. But my mother really helped me when she stopped. And I got all my belongings in 3 green hefty trash can liners, colors, whites, and paraphernalia. And I threw them in the back of an old pickup truck and headed for No Hope, Kentucky on Skid Row on 15th and Scott. And I always describe this room because I don't ever want to forget, because if I were to drink it today, this would be peanuts. My illness has progressed over 19 years. This was back then in 75, 76. But this room was green. It was all green. Floor, ceiling, walls, everything was green. Big piece of linoleum. It was curled up all the way around. I had plastic curtains with grease on the blinds. I had a 4-pane window, and one of the panes were broken out. I had a light that hung by a wire on the ceiling. I had a bare mattress on the floor for a bed and a cardboard box turned upside down for an end table. And you know what I thought when I come in here drunk? Isn't this great? Oh, this is great. I don't have to listen to her complain about my drinking anymore. This is fantastic. You know, you lay there and you flick a roach off. You adapt. You know, I didn't know they call that acceptance in AA, but I adapted. And I didn't know why I was on Skid Row. You know why I thought I was on Skid Row? Because of my mother. It never occurred to me that it might be my drinking. Never. Never occurred to me it was my drinking. I remember on January the 18th, 1977, I had lost the ability to work. I was 21. I'd just turned 22. And I'd hitchhiked back up to the community I grew up in as a kid to hustle drinks. And all of you have hustled drinks, and you'll know what I mean. Because I went in there, and I hadn't seen these fellows in a few months, and they'd say, hey, Joe, how you doing? I haven't seen you in a while. Let me buy you a drink. I said, that's a good idea. Why don't you do that? That's called hustle. That's not socialization. That's an alcoholic hustling a drink. And if you hustle enough, you can get a drink. And I got drunk, and this night on the 18th of January 1977, I was acting bizarre. It was 2:30 in the morning and the bars closed where I'm from. And I had done one of those stupid things like stick my thumb in somebody's eye in a blackout just to watch him tear up. I mean, something ignorant, something stupid, you know what I mean? I could sit there and have a conversation with you about current events and all of a sudden, boom, just do something stupid like that, come back out of it, and I'm hearing chairs and stuff moving, wondering what's going on. What's going on is me. I didn't know it was, and people knew that. They said, he's not right. Stay away from him. There was another guy like me that drank in that bar. He was a painter, and when he got like I got, he started singing, doctor, oh, doctor. I mean, he was like I was. And the doors closed to that bar. The doors closed to that bar. It's 2:30 in the morning, and I look around. There's nobody around. No hat on, no gloves, old Navy pea coat on, had bib overalls on, a shirt, socks, and shoes. It was 25 degrees below, and the wind chill was 70 below. I don't know if you guys ever been in it. That's cold. That is, dogs are frozen to fire hydrants. I mean, that, nothing is moving. If it's out, it's not moving. And I walked about a mile and a half, and it was bitter. I mean, when it gets below 20 now, my face and my ears and stuff hurt. I think I damaged myself that night. And I walked about a mile and a half, and some guy picked me up, and he drove me downtown to Cincinnati. And I remember getting out of the car, and the car went away, and there it was. There was nobody around anymore. And the wind is howling, 70 below. It feels like little needles just hitting you constantly. And I stood inside the doorway of a building downtown, and I looked up at the clock on the crew tower, and it said 3:45. And I thought, well, if I start walking now, I can make it over the river and go up 15 blocks. I'll be home in a half hour. And I remember walking over the bridge that night, and the river froze that year. People walked over the Ohio River. That's a big river. It was frozen. And if you'd have stopped me in the middle of that bridge that night, at 4 o'clock in the morning, 70 below, and I'm staggering, he said, Joe, do you think you might have a problem with your drinking? I said, well, hell no, I don't have a problem with my drinking. I've got a transportation problem. I've got 30 cents, but the buses aren't running. And believe that. That's the sick thing. I would have believed that because that's what I believe. And seeing how we're the only two out here on the bridge and it's 4 a.m, let me tell you what my problem is. It's that mother that kicked me out. She went to AA. She's crazy. She's just nuts. If she wouldn't have went to AA, my parents wouldn't have got divorced, I'd be a college graduate right now. No, but I'm out here looking for a bus. It's the Navy that didn't want to buy into my game. It's the girlfriend that dumped me. It's the boss that didn't understand I couldn't show up because I was out a little bit too late too many times. It's the lack of education. That's what it is. If I had a college degree, maybe I wouldn't be out here in the cold. Maybe if I had a little cash, maybe that's it. I believe that. I believe that's why I was out on that bridge at 4 a.m, 70 below wind chill. That's called delusion. That has nothing to do with denial at all. Denial's petty. Denial's of Frank. Frank says, you took my wallet. I said, mm-mm. He said, yeah, you did. I said, no, I didn't. It's to keep Frank from killing me or getting arrested. I am aware of what I'm doing. Own up to it to pay the consequences. That's denial. Our book uses the word, the delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. That's in reference to my drinking as an alcoholic. And sober, is he not victim of a delusion that he can wrest satisfaction out of his world if only he manages well? I looked that up in the dictionary. Delusion is a life that cannot be shaken by the truth or facts. You could have told me the truth, and I would have said, you're crazy. My mother told me the truth, and I said, you're crazy. I would not have believed you. How could it be the alcohol? I was 15 years old at that freshman dance. I couldn't dance. I was afraid. My butt was glued up against the wall with all those other boys 15 years old that were afraid to dance. But I was one of the lucky ones. I was alcoholic. I knew what to say. I was afraid to say it. Michael, would you like to dance? And she says, no. I said, well, thank you. Vanessa, would you like to dance? I couldn't do it. I was afraid for the guys. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. It's like, come on, Chuck. Don't pay attention to what they think. We'll just finish this out. Anything that makes you feel that good, that takes that fear away, is the solution. It's not the problem. So you have to know what your problem is in order to deny it. I didn't know what my problem was, and I didn't know, I was in a delusion, like our book talks about. To the person who's looking at somebody like me walking across the bridge, they go, it's obvious to me he's got a drinking problem, but he won't own up to it, so he's denying it. The guy walking across the bridge doesn't know what his problem is. That's alcoholism. He has no choice and doesn't know what his problem is. That's, I believe, the dilemma that our book talks about. I remember it warming up a little bit. It was March 1977, and I'm still believing all these lies. My life's getting worse. The window's still busted out. No job. No truck. They took the truck away. It froze in the ice. I didn't have any money to get it. They towed it away. And I'm sitting there. I got a little dried puke on my bib coveralls. My hair's out to here. And I'm watching couples go up and down the street on a Friday night. I smell funny. I look funny. I haven't bathed in days. And I'm thinking, wonder why I can't get a date. That's my problem. If I could get a date. We laugh at that now, but you know, I believe that. I believe that with my heart and soul. And later on, the next day, I would wake up and the madness would hit and I'd have to get some wine. I'd have to get it. I had to get it. I had to. Alcohol was not my drug of choice. I'm an alcoholic. I am powerless over alcohol. I had no choice. I had to have that drink. And as I was drinking a bottle of MD 2020, I had my face pressed up against the chain link fence of a parochial schoolyard, quarter after 9 in the morning, watching little kids play, 9 and 10 or 10 again. I'd give anything to go home to my mother and say, Mom, Jesus, I didn't really mean to turn out to be like this. Please, please give me another chance. I'll do better. And I finished the bottle off, and I knew I wasn't going to do better. I knew I was going to go back up the street, maybe get some wild Irish rose. I wasn't going to be 9 or 10 years old no more. I was going to go back and get another bottle of wine because I had to. I had no choice. I'm an alcoholic. I had a spiritual experience on April the 9th, 1977, and I'm not going to go into it because I've got about 15 minutes, be exactly an hour. We're out of here in an hour. Unless you set your clock back. I had something happen to me, and it wasn't enough to keep me sober, but it was enough to introduce me to you. I had a spiritual awakening, and this was really bizarre. I was closer to my mother's house that day when the sun came up than I was in the other state across the river in Kentucky. And for some reason, I went to my mother's house. Now, my mother had a restraining order on me. I was not allowed within 100 feet of the house. She changed the locks. She was afraid of me. I was an idiot. I was sick. I was unpredictable. I couldn't predict my own behavior. She was afraid of me. I put holes in walls like that in her house. And I went to her back door, and she looked at me, and she let me in. And she was getting ready to go work the coffee bar at the local AA clubhouse. That was her source of income. And I said, Mom, did you ever get the feeling that the harder you tried to get somewhere in life, the farther back you fell? She said, oh, yeah. She says, I know what that feels like. She says, lock up when you leave. And I sat in the recliner, and I remember coming to a little bit before noon, and there was something different. My mind was as clear then as it is right now. I just was not armed with the facts about myself and what alcoholism was, and I had it. I called my mother. I said, I don't have to drink no more. And she's crying in the background. She puts me on the phone with this guy and says, you think you might have a problem with your drinking? I said, well, I don't know. I might. That's what I believe. You know, just because you have a spiritual awakening doesn't mean all your old ideas are gone. Just means God giving you a little grace for a few seconds, you know. And he says, why don't you come on down to the meeting? I says, look, I'm going to go back over the river and go back to my room. And I said, I'm just exhausted. I'm going to go back up to the community bathtub on the second floor that everybody in the building uses. I'm going to get a bath. I'm going to go to sleep. I'll be down the next night. And you know, I went there the next day. April the 10th, 1977. I'm 22 years old. My hair is out to here. I have no underwear on, no shirt, no socks, an old pair of worn-out earth shoes, and bib overalls. Now, I knew when I walked in there that day, somebody was going to look at me and say, man, why don't you get a haircut? Why don't you take a bath? That last one's null and void. Job! Why don't you get some clothes, get some underwear, man? What the hell's wrong with you? It's cool out. I knew they were going to say that to me because that's what I said in the mirror above my sink in my room every morning. I would wake up and look at myself and say, Jesus, Joe, look at you. Look at you. You're a mess. Your hair's out the hair. You look like a werewolf. What's wrong with you? You can't get up to get a job. You can't stop drinking. What is wrong with you? And that's how I talk to myself every day. So I just assumed that's what these people were going to do. And when I walked in 1977, there weren't a lot of 22-year-old kids in the area that I grew up in, that I got sober in. These people were old enough to be my parents and grandparents. I looked at that, I thought, what are we going to do here, poker, a little bridge Friday night, or what? the hand that's trying to help me. I think it's part of the sickness. And this woman was old. Jesus, she was old. She was 40. I'm 42. 50 seems rather mild, Michael. But she said, if you want to find a way up and out of your problems, we'll share with you how we did it. She didn't say, we'll tell you what to do. Because people like me are spiritually dyslexic. I get things backwards. People that try to help me, I think they're trying to hurt me. But with people who talk about themselves, I go, isn't that fascinating? Tell me more. It's not offensive. I don't have to feel defensive. I just listen to the story. And this guy says, we don't know if you're an alcoholic like we are, but if you are, you're in the grips of a progressive, fatal, incurable illness. Never gets any better without spiritual release. True for you, you old fart, you drank 30 years. You drank that long, you got to talk about God. There's nothing left. I'm here to tell you, a year and a half later, there was nothing to talk about God, but there was nothing left in my life. And I heard a guy get up and tell a story, something like I'm doing now. And he had just gotten a sponsor. He wanted to let everybody know, too. He said it over and over and over. I'm sober. Everybody's got a sponsor. I want one. Get one. That's all. I didn't even know what it was. It's my first day at AA. I didn't know what the hell a sponsor was. And after the meeting, I asked the guy next to me, would you be my sponsor? And he said, yeah. He's been my sponsor ever since. And people ask me from time to time, how do you pick a sponsor? And I said, well, from my own experience, just ask somebody. Don't make a big deal out of it. And they go, he's such a wise ass. Well, it's my experience. And this guy that I asked was a big book nut. And he says, Joe, this is what I do to stay sober. He says, I have a home group I attend every week. He said, I go to at least one institution meeting a week. He said, I have a sponsor that I have contact with on a regular basis. I have gone through the steps. And he says, I have read this book and tried to do what it says to do. Now, this is my first day at AA. I look at this book. I thought, there's not one damn picture in this book. There are no literary giants where I'm living on Skid Row. And I get a book in their back pocket reading books with no pictures. I thought there at least ought to be a picture of the co-founder passed out in a bathtub or something. You know, like one of those diet ads. Here's Bill drunk. Here is Bill sober. Check that out. I got to get some of that. He gave me this book, and I thought, I'll come to these meetings, but I'm not reading that book. Because I was still believing that money and all that other stuff was my problem, see? So I come around 89 days going to a meeting every day, started to smoke marijuana. I'd ask my sponsor about it. What do you think about that? He said, well, if you haven't had a problem with it, I suggest you smoke it. Oh, wow, that's a good sponsor there. I like that. And he knew that I had to be convinced. That I had to rely on a power that wasn't going to run out. So I come back to AA after 89 days, and there he was. I said, would you still be my sponsor? And he said, yeah. I stayed sober 4 months this time and drank. I stayed sober 5 months the next time and drank. Chaired the meeting the fifth month. The last day of the fifth month that I chaired, I walked out of the meeting. I'm walking down the street, and my head says, a bottle of MD-2020 go real good right now. And my head says, you're a big boy, go get it. And I went and got it. And I'm halfway done with this bottle of MD-2020, and my mind says, you are crazy. You've just been to 5 months of meetings and chaired a meeting of AA, and you're drinking Mad Dog. AA doesn't work for people like you. You're a loser. You're never going to amount to nothing. Things get better for those people, but you're a loser. You are never going to get better. Just accept it. And I went in and out of AA and experienced loneliness like people like us know. I think the loneliness hurt me more than the booze did, really. Because I remember sitting in the bar, having a couple drinks, my hair's still out here. I'd look in that mirror, I'd get that Estee Lauder look, handsome and debonair. Have two more drinks, 5 minutes later, puke on the bar, they'd kick me out. Couldn't keep anything down. And I'm standing out front going, if I don't belong there and I don't belong in AA, where do I belong? It doesn't sound like much, but it was my whole world. It was my whole world. And I went in and out of AA, I went through a hospital for alcoholism one time, was drunk within a week out of there. And I came back on October the 5th, 1978, didn't know that was going to be my sobriety date, had no idea. But it was an eating meeting, I was hungry. And I knew I could show up and get free food and act like a good AA member and get the hell out of there, because those people were bizarre, they were strange. They weren't drinking, they had jobs, clothes, cars, I couldn't identify with them. And I don't remember what was said at the meeting that night, but I'll tell you something, I remember what was said in the car after the meeting. My sponsor's car. He said, "Joe, I want to help you. You saved my life this past year." Now, here we are, hair out to here. I smell like a goat. I got that Charlie Manson look. No money, no job, no car. He says I saved his life. That's what I'm thinking. What I said was, "Oh, really, Mike? Tell me more." He said, "Yeah, I watched my mother die of leukemia this past year, Joe, and between the chemotherapy and the cancer, she shriveled up, her hair fell out, and she died." He said, "I could taste whiskey in my mouth. I could taste it going down." He said, "I was ready to drink, but every time I wanted to drink, you drank. And I saw what it was doing to you in your life at that time, and I figured I just didn't need that right now in my life. Thanks. You teach me a lot." And I didn't think at him that time. It was the first time I said what was on my mind in a long time. I said, "You son of a bitch, I'm not teaching you anymore." I did not come to AA to find a better way of life. I came back to AA to get even with him. Because he was hustling me, he was using me. And I didn't mind hustling you, but don't hustle me. And I walked away from that car with no place to go and nothing, and I thought, "You think you're so smart. I'll prove to you A doesn't work for losers like me. I'm going to read that book, doesn't have a picture, and I'm going to try to do what it says to do. I'm going to go to the same meetings you go to. I'm going to smoke the same cigarettes you smoke. I'm going to tell the same stupid jokes you tell every night, over and over and over. And when it doesn't work out, like everything I've tried my whole life, even AA, I could say, told you so. You were wrong." And I've been sober ever since then, October 5th, 1978. I was a sick kid. I was 23 years old. I didn't know how sick I was. I really didn't. I started to read this book, and I didn't understand it. I couldn't retain anything, but I had a sponsor who made this thing so simple for me. He was my understanding. I could see it in his life, and when he would say something, I'd go, "Is that what that means in the big book?" He says, "Yeah, I believe that does, Joe." I said, "Why do you run around with all these old people?" He said, "Well, you can't tell the age of an alcoholic by the odor of their vomit." That's pretty spiritual, isn't it? That's part of my foundation. And I said, "Well, what is this spirituality stuff?" And he knew I was sick. And he just kept it so simple. He said, "Joe, spirituality is a way of life that will allow you to be in good spirits so you don't have to drink anymore." Oh, well, that ain't bad. I can buy that. He put God to me in such a way that a sick mind could say, oh, okay, that's not too bad. He presented God to me in a form that alcoholics understand. God is in the form of a desire to stay sober, and later it turns into something that's so wonderful you can't even put words on it. But that's the God that he introduced me to. God gave me a job in AA. I was at the coffee bar. He said, you need a job? I said, you talking to me? Trick question? Me? And he said, yeah. And I started working. And I hear people say, you can't get a job hanging out in AA. I got mine. And that guy taught me a trade, and it eventually led me to the job that I've been on since 1980 now. I got to 30 days, I was getting ready to drink again. I could feel it. I knew what that feeling is. I got to go. I can't take it. I can't take it. And I said, Mike, what'd you do when you got like that? He said, I wrote that stuff down that was bothering me, Joe. Resentment, fear, and sex. And he just explained to me what those were. He said, resentment's something you think about that happened in the past. And every time you think about it, you grit your teeth because it just kills you. And fear is the stuff that makes you uncomfortable when you think about it. Usually stuff that might happen in the future. And he says, you know what to write down about sex. He said, you write that down. So I went back to my room and I wrote that stuff down. I said, you need me to stay sober like you say you do. Listen to this. I'll blow him away. And I thought, oh yeah, don't want to forget that. Yeah. And wait till I tell him about that buffalo from Billings, Montana. He'll like that. That's part of my sex inventory. And I thought, what are you laughing at? I found out, I've been around 19 years, I found everybody got a buffalo. Just some of them are willing to admit it. Ain't that right, Michael? Buffalo. And I went and read this stuff to him. And he said, can you see where you're at fault in any of that? I said, well, no, why? I couldn't. I literally could not. And he looked at me like, this guy is sick. And he explained to me things in his life where he had found out where he had been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. I went, oh, my God. You think maybe that's where I'm at? He says, I don't know. What do you think, Joe? It's your inventory. And I finished doing that with him, and I went back, and my reflection on the sixth step was, how could you have embarrassed yourself in front of another human being like that? That was my first sixth step. I was just embarrassed. And I did the seventh step in my room. I asked God to take all of me. And I went ahead and made those amends, and my life changed so fast, I had to keep coming back to A to find out what was going on. I got sober and started going to meetings, and I knew I had surrendered because my sponsor did weird things. I was sober 3 days. He called the building that I lived in, and the woman says, there's a guy from Alcoholics Anonymous on the phone, wants to talk to you. I went, oh, Christ, they all know I'm an alcoholic now. Everybody in the building was alcoholic. I was just the only one under 65. And I got on the phone. He says, I need somebody to talk at the workhouse tonight. Can you do it? And before I could say yes or no, I said, well, I'm sober 3 days. What am I going to tell them? He said, why don't you tell them what it's like to be sober 3 days? I said, all right. And I hung up. I went, oh, no, that was dumb. So I'm on the bus. I have a buck and a quarter. I use 30 cents to ride the bus to meet this guy. And I'm 3 days sober. And I'm on the back of the bus on the bench seat. It's just me and the driver. The bus is empty. And I'm hearing the hum of the motor, and I'm going up and down. I'm thinking, you've really lost it. You're 3 days sober. You're going to meet a guy you think's hustling you. You talk to a group of people you don't know to tell them what it's like to be sober 3 days. You've lost your better judgment. And I went and talked in there for 5-10 minutes, and as we left, my sponsor said, see, that helped you stay sober, didn't it? And I thought, you dummy, there's no beer in there. You know. But my action said, I'll do anything, even if it doesn't make sense to me. I started going to AA, and my life started to unfold. I was sober a couple years, got married. Married a hell of a gal. God put a good woman in my life. I didn't have enough sense to pick a good woman. I pick out weird women.
I do. My picker is broke. But she kind of picked me, and we got to know each other that way. And we got married, and I remember I was sober about 2.5 years and learned how to fly a plane. I flew over that sleeping room that I was in. About 5 years sober, my wife had a baby, Babs. I used to say, we had a baby. Shoot, I saw it. She had the baby. I was in the delivery room going, oh, my God, look at, oh. You know what was running through my mind? Things will never be the same. Look at, oh. You know me, always thinking of others, you know. We named this little boy Mike after my sponsor. And you know what? A year later, on the same day, she did it again. That's what I said to her. Mike was 3 months old. She says, I'm pregnant. I said, what? Every year on November the 20th, oh, you got to cut this out. I can't deal with that. And I'm going to talk to you about this little boy. This little boy we named Bob after my sponsor's sponsor. Bob was a local graduate of the psych ward, and A, had changed his life, and we thought a lot of Bob. Bob was born with his feet on upside down, severe club feet. His feet, they were like that, and upside down. And I was sitting there in the delivery room, and they pulled him out, and I could hear the doctor say, he's just fine. And I thought, I'm not dumb, doc. Kid looks like Flipper. I mean, I can see. I didn't know what to say. I mean, what do you say? What, really? What do you say when something like that happens? I said nothing. And but I know this, there's a God. I was sober about 6 years, and God put an alcoholic in my life that day to show me there was nothing to worry about. Within 4 hours of that boy being born, I stood in the courtroom, and I watched him bring an alcoholic in who had been to AA before, didn't think he needed it, thought he was a drug addict. Now he's standing there facing 5 life sentences for drinking whiskey. That alcoholic was my brother. Shackles on his ankles and handcuffs to a waist belt. My mother's crying. My father's rocking back and forth because he can't do anything for his little boy anymore. And I looked at him and I looked at me and I thought, what's the difference? The difference was you. The difference was Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the only difference. I walked out of that courtroom and I went up to my wife and I said, everything's going to be fine. She said, how do you know? I said, I just know. She says, no, really. How do you know? I said, look, I just watched an alcoholic today lose the right to ever be a father again. Alcoholism ripped it right out of his life. He'll never be able to buy a dress for his daughter, buy her first dress, never be able to watch his boy play a ball game. I said, it doesn't matter if Bob walks. I can kiss him on the cheek and tell him I love him. We've got to push him in a wheelchair. That'll be fine. Bob ended up having operations on his feet, and everything turned out okay. And braces and cast over a period of years, and he does just fine. God gave him one hell of a mind. That boy's way smart. I mean, he'll never have to use his feet. We saw a guy spill a whole thing of water up here. And what did everybody do? They laugh. I had a guy ask me one time, he says, why is it we give people in AA more slack than we do our own family? He says, I don't know, Jerry, what do you mean? He says, did you ever notice when somebody spills a cup of coffee or water at an AA meeting, people laugh, they go, look at that, still fill himself sober. I'll be back, I'll help you wipe that up. But let one of our children spill a cup of coffee on the dining room table and Jesus Christ! Oh, you hold it like this. And if you can't do that, don't bring it in here. Because I don't know, Jerry. I never thought about that. You know, So I went home from the convention. That was up in North Dakota, of all places. And Monday, there was Bob. Bob spills everything when he eats. Today, it still bothers me, but I'm better.
a little bit. He dropped a piece of butter bread, butter side down, on the kitchen floor, and he looked at me and went, "Oh, here comes Dad from hell." Oh. Because I can really be overbearing, and sometimes I scare myself sometimes. And he looked at me, and I looked at him. I thought, how would I treat that boy if he was a member of AA? I said, "Hey, Bob, tap your foot on the floor." He said, "Why?" I said, "Hell, the dog would get it." There's still some down there. He said, "Still some there, Bob." I said, "Tap your foot on the floor again." The dog come over, licked it up. By the time he got done licking that butter up, we were laughing so hard, we were crying. I said, "What do you think of that? We've got a vacuum cleaner on four legs with hair. What do you think about that?" See, on my own, I can't come up with stuff like that. I need you to put perspective into my life. On my own, I'm nothing. Hey, I'm not kidding anybody. I'm a drunk. I come a dime a dozen. If I wasn't here tonight, you'd have somebody else up here. I'm not important. I need you more today than I ever have in my life. I still make mistakes, and I'm still growing. Hell, I offended my wife today, and I had to go back and say, "Gee, I feel like a jerk. I shouldn't have said that. I was wrong. I'm sorry." You taught me how to do that. You taught me that. And for you people who are new, and that guy with 3 days, if you don't remember nothing in this last 65 minutes, you remember this. Please remember this. We don't care where you come from. We don't care how you got here. We don't care who you did it with. We already know. Alcoholics Anonymous, don't you ever forget that if you want to stay sober with us, because by God, they let me in very much.